Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Art of Seduction by Robert Greene, narrated by Joseph Powers.
Preface. Thousands of years ago, power was mostly gained through physical violence and maintained with brute strength. There was little need for subtlety. A king or emperor had to be merciless. Only a select few had power, but no one suffered under this scheme of things more than women. They had no way to compete, no weapon at their disposal that could make a man do what they wanted, politically, socially, or even in the home. Of course, men had one weakness, their insatiable desire for sex. A woman could always toy with this desire, but once she gave in to sex, the man was back in control. And if she withheld sex, he could simply look elsewhere or exert force. What good was a power that was so temporary and frail? Yet women had no choice but to submit to this condition. There were some, though, whose hunger for power was too great, and who, over the years, through much cleverness and creativity, invented a way of turning the dynamic around, creating a more lasting and effective form of power. These women, among them Bathsheba from the Old Testament, Helen of Troy, the Chinese siren Xi Shi, and the greatest of them all, Cleopatra, invented seduction. First, they would draw a man in with an alluring appearance, designing their makeup and adornment to fashion the image of a goddess come to life. By showing only glimpses of flesh, they would tease a man's imagination, stimulating the desire not just for sex, but for something greater. The chance to possess a fantasy figure. Once they had their victim's interest, these women would lure them away from the masculine world of war and politics and get them to spend time in the feminine world, a world of luxury, spectacle, and pleasure. They might also lead them astray, literally, taking them on a journey, as Cleopatra lured Julius Caesar on a trip down the Nile. Men would grow hooked on these refined, sensual pleasures. They would fall in love. But then, invariably, the women would turn cold and indifferent, confusing their victims. Just when the men wanted more, they found their pleasures withdrawn. They would be forced into pursuit, trying anything to win back the favors they once had tasted, and growing weak and emotional in the process. Men who had physical force and all the social power, men like King David, the Trojan Paris, Julius Caesar, Mark Antony, King Fu Chai, would find themselves becoming the slave of a woman. In the face of violence and brutality, these women made seduction a sophisticated art, the ultimate form of power and persuasion. They learned to work on the mind first, stimulating fantasies, keeping a man wanting more, creating patterns of hope and despair, the essence of seduction. Their power was not physical, but psychological, not forceful, but indirect and cunning. These first great seductresses were like military generals planning the destruction of an enemy. And indeed, early accounts of seduction often compare it to battle, the feminine version of warfare. For Cleopatra, it was a means of consolidating an empire. In seduction, the woman was no longer a passive sex object. She had become an active agent, a figure of power. With a few exceptions, the Latin poet Ovid, the medieval troubadours, men didn't much concern themselves with such a frivolous art as seduction. Then in the 17th century came a great change. Men grew interested in seduction as a way to overcome a young woman's resistance to sex. History's first great male seducers, the Duke de Lauzun, the different Spaniards who inspired the Don Juan legend, began to adopt the methods traditionally employed by women. They learned to dazzle with their appearance, often androgynous in nature, to stimulate the imagination, to play the coquette. They also added a new, masculine element to the game, seductive language, for they had discovered a woman's weakness for soft words. These two forms of seduction, the feminine use of appearances and the masculine use of language, would often cross gender lines. Casanova would dazzle a woman with his clothes. Ninon de l'Enclos would charm a man with her words. At the same time that men were developing their version of seduction, others began to adapt the art for social purposes. As Europe's feudal system of government faded into the past, courtiers needed to get their way in court without the use of force. They learned the power to be gained by seducing their superiors and competitors through psychological games, soft words, a little coquetry. As culture became democratized, actors, dandies, and artists came to use the tactics of seduction as a way to charm and win over their audience and social milieu. In the 19th century, another great change occurred. Politicians like Napoleon consciously saw themselves as seducers on a grand scale. These men depended on the art of seductive oratory, but they also mastered what had once been feminine strategies, staging vast spectacles, using theatrical devices, creating a charged physical presence. All this, they learned, was the essence of charisma, and remains so today. By seducing the masses, they could accumulate immense power without the use of force. Today, we have reached the ultimate point in the evolution of seduction. Now, more than ever, force or brutality of any kind is discouraged. All areas of social life require the ability to persuade people in a way that does not offend or impose itself. Forms of seduction can be found everywhere, blending male and female strategies. Advertisements insinuate, the soft sell dominates. If we are to change people's opinions, and affecting opinion is basic to seduction, we must act in subtle, subliminal ways. Today, no political campaign can work without seduction. Since the era of John F. Kennedy, political figures are required to have a degree of charisma, a fascinating presence to keep their audience's attention, which is half the battle. The film world and media create a galaxy of seductive stars and images. We are saturated in the seductive. But even if much has changed in degree and scope, the essence of seduction is constant. Never be forceful or direct. Instead, use pleasure as bait, playing on people's emotions, stirring desire and confusion, inducing psychological surrender. In seduction, as it's practiced today, the methods of Cleopatra still hold. People are constantly trying to influence us, to tell us what to do. And just as often, we tune them out, resisting their attempts at persuasion. There is a moment in our lives, however, when we all act differently, when we are in love. We fall under a kind of spell. Our minds are usually preoccupied with our own concerns. Now, they become filled with thoughts of the loved one. We grow emotional, lose the ability to think straight, act in foolish ways that we would never do otherwise. If this goes on long enough, something inside us gives way. We surrender to the will of the loved one and to our desire to possess them. Seducers are people who understand the tremendous power contained in such moments of surrender. They analyze what happens when people are in love, study the psychological components of the process, what spurs the imagination, what casts a spell. By instinct and through practice, they master the art of making people fall in love. As the first seductresses knew, it is much more effective to create love than lust. A person in love is emotional, pliable, and easily misled. The origin of the word seduction is the Latin for to lead astray. A person in lust is harder to control, and once satisfied, may easily leave you. Seducers take their time, create enchantment and the bonds of love, so that when sex ensues, it only further enslaves the victim. Creating love and enchantment becomes the model for all seductions, sexual, social, political. A person in love will surrender. It's pointless to try to argue against such power, to imagine that you are not interested in it, or that it's evil and ugly. The harder you try to resist the lure of seduction as an idea, as a form of power, the more you will find yourself fascinated. The reason is simple. Most of us have known the power of having someone fall in love with us. Our actions, gestures, the things we say, all have positive effects on this person. We may not completely understand what we've done right, but this feeling of power is intoxicating. It gives us confidence, which makes us more seductive. We may also experience this in a social or work setting. One day, we're in an elevated mood, and people seem more responsive, more charmed by us. These moments of power are fleeting, but they resonate in the memory with great intensity. We want them back. Nobody likes to feel awkward or timid or unable to reach people. The siren call of seduction is irresistible because power is irresistible, and nothing will bring you more power in the modern world than the ability to seduce. Repressing the desire to seduce is a kind of hysterical reaction, revealing your deep-down fascination with the process. You are only making your desires stronger. Someday, they will come to the surface. To have such power doesn't require a total transformation in your character or any kind of physical improvement in your looks. Seduction is a game of psychology, not beauty, and it's within the grasp of any person to become a master at the game. All that is required is that you look at the world differently, through the eyes of a seducer. A seducer doesn't turn the power off and on. Every social and personal interaction is seen as a potential seduction. There's never a moment to waste. This is so for several reasons. The power seducers have over a man or woman works in social environments because they have learned how to tone down the sexual element without getting rid of it. We may think we see through them, but they are so pleasant to be around anyway that it doesn't matter. Trying to divide your life into moments in which you seduce and others in which you hold back will only confuse and constrain you. Erotic desire and love lurk beneath the surface of almost every human encounter. Better to give free rein to your skills than try to use them only in the bedroom. In fact, the seducer sees the world as his or her bedroom. This attitude creates great seductive momentum, and with each seduction you gain experience and practice. One social or sexual seduction makes the next one easier, your confidence growing and making you more alluring. People are drawn to you in greater numbers as the seducer's aura descends upon you. Seducers have a warrior's outlook on life. They see each person as a kind of walled castle to which they are laying siege. Seduction is a process of penetration. Initially, penetrating the target's mind, their first point of defense. Once seducers have penetrated the mind, making the target fantasize about them, it's easy to lower resistance and create physical surrender. Seducers don't improvise. They don't leave this process to chance. Like any good general, they plan and strategize, aiming at the target's particular weaknesses. The main obstacle to becoming a seducer is this foolish prejudice we have of seeing love and romance as some kind of sacred, magical realm where things just fall into place, if they are meant to. This might seem romantic and quaint, but it's really just a cover for our laziness. What will seduce a person is the effort we expend on their behalf, showing how much we care, how much they are worth. Leaving things to chance is a recipe for disaster and reveals that we don't take love and romance very seriously. It was the effort Casanova expended, the artfulness he applied to each affair that made him so devilishly seductive. Falling in love is a matter not of magic, but of psychology. Once you understand your target's psychology and strategize to suit it, you will be better able to cast a magical spell. A seducer sees love not as sacred, but as warfare, where all is fair. Seducers are never self-absorbed. Their gaze is directed outward, not inward. When they meet someone, their first move is to get inside that person's skin, to see the world through their eyes. The reasons for this are several. First, self-absorption is a sign of insecurity. It is anti-seductive. Everyone has insecurities, but seducers manage to ignore them, finding therapy for moments of self-doubt by being absorbed in the world. This gives them a buoyant spirit. We want to be around them. Second, getting into someone's skin, imagining what it's like to be them, helps the seducer gather valuable information, learn what makes that person tick, what will make them lose their ability to think straight, and fall into a trap. Armed with such information, they can provide focused and individualized attention, a rare commodity in a world in which most people see us only from behind the screen of their own prejudices. Getting into the target's skin is the first important tactical move in the war of penetration. Seducers see themselves as providers of pleasure, like bees that gather pollen from some flowers and deliver it to others. As children, we mostly devoted our lives to play and pleasure. Adults often have feelings of being cut off from this paradise, of being weighed down by responsibilities. The seducer knows that people are waiting for pleasure. They never get enough of it from friends and lovers, and they cannot get it by themselves. A person who enters their lives offering adventure and romance cannot be resisted. Pleasure is a feeling of being taken past our limits, of being overwhelmed by another person, by an experience. People are dying to be overwhelmed, to let go of their usual stubbornness. Sometimes their resistance to us is a way of saying, "Please seduce me." Seducers know that the possibility of pleasure will make a person follow them, and the experience of it will make someone open up, weak to the touch. They also train themselves to be sensitive to pleasure, knowing that feeling pleasure themselves will make it that much easier for them to infect the people around them. A seducer sees all of life as theater, everyone an actor. Most people feel they have constricted roles in life, which makes them unhappy. Seducers, on the other hand, can be anyone and can assume many roles. The archetype here is the god Zeus, insatiable seducer of young maidens, whose main weapon was the ability to assume the form of whatever person or animal would most appeal to his victim. Seducers take pleasure in performing and aren't weighed down by their identity or by some need to be themselves or to be natural. This freedom of theirs, this fluidity in body and spirit, is what makes them attractive. What people lack in life is not more reality, but illusion, fantasy, play. The clothes that seducers wear, the places they take you to, their words and actions are slightly heightened. Not overly theatrical, but with a delightful edge of unreality, as if the two of you were living out a piece of fiction or were characters in a film. Seduction is a kind of theater in real life, the meeting of illusion and reality. Finally, seducers are completely amoral in their approach to life. It is all a game, an arena for play. Knowing that the moralists, the crabbed, repressed types who croak about the evils of the seducer, secretly envy their power, they do not concern themselves with other people's opinions. They don't deal in moral judgments. Nothing could be less seductive. Everything is pliant, fluid, like life itself. Seduction is a form of deception, but people want to be led astray. They yearn to be seduced. If they didn't, seducers wouldn't find so many willing victims. Get rid of any moralizing tendencies. Adopt the seducer's playful philosophy, and you will find the rest of the process easy and natural. The art of seduction is designed to arm you with weapons of persuasion and charm, so that those around you will slowly lose their ability to resist without knowing how or why it's happened. It is an art of war for delicate times. Every seduction has two elements that you must analyze and understand. First, yourself and what is seductive about you. And second, your target and the actions that will penetrate their defenses and create surrender. The two sides are equally important. If you strategize without paying attention to the parts of your character that draw people to you, you will be seen as a mechanical seducer, slimy and manipulative. If you rely on your seductive personality without paying attention to the other person, you will make terrible mistakes and limit your potential. Consequently, the art of seduction is divided into two parts. The first half, the seductive character, describes the 9 types of seducer, plus the anti-seducer. Studying these types will make you aware of what is inherently seductive in your character, the basic building block of any seduction. The second half, the seductive process, includes the 24 maneuvers and strategies that will instruct you on how to create a spell, break down people's resistance, give movement and force to your seduction, and induce surrender in your target. As a kind of bridge between the two parts, there is a chapter on the 18 types of victims of a seduction, each of them missing something from their lives, each cradling an emptiness you can fill. Knowing what type you are dealing with will help you put into practice the ideas in both sections. Ignore any part of this book, and you will be an incomplete seducer. The ideas and strategies in The Art of Seduction are based on the writings and historical accounts of the most successful seducers in history. The sources include the seducer's own memoirs by Casanova, Errol Flynn, Natalie Barney, Marilyn Monroe, biographies of Cleopatra, Josephine Bonaparte, John F. Kennedy, Duke Ellington, handbooks on the subject, most notably Ovid's Art of Love, and fictional accounts of seductions, Choderlos de Laclos' Dangerous Liaisons, Soren Kierkegaard's The Seducer's Diary, Murasaki Shikibu's The Tale of Genji. The heroes and heroines of these literary works are generally modeled on real-life seducers. The strategies they employ reveal the intimate connection between fiction and seduction, creating illusion and leading a person along. In putting the book's lessons into practice, you will be following in the path of the greatest masters of the art. Finally, the spirit that will make you a consummate seducer is the spirit in which you should read this book. The French writer Denis Diderot once wrote, "I give my mind the liberty to follow the first wise or foolish idea that presents itself, just as in the Avenue de Foy, our dissolute youths follow close on the heels of some strumpet, then leave her to pursue another, attacking all of them and attaching themselves to none. My thoughts are my strumpets." He meant that he let himself be seduced by ideas, following whichever one caught his fancy until a better one came along, his thoughts infused with a kind of sexual excitement. Once you enter these pages, do as Diderot advised. Let yourself be lured by the stories and ideas, your mind open and your thoughts fluid. Slowly, you will find yourself absorbing the poison through the skin, and you will begin to see everything as a seduction, including the way you think and how you look at the world. A quotation by Chaudelot de Laclos from On the Education of Women, translated by Lydia Davis in The Libertine Reader, edited by Michel Ferrer. Oppression and scorn, thus, were and must have been generally the share of women in emerging societies. This state lasted in all its force until centuries of experience taught them to substitute skill for force. Women at last sensed that, since they were weaker, their only resource was to seduce. They understood that if they were dependent on men through force, men could become dependent on them through pleasure. More unhappy than men, they must have thought and reflected earlier than did men. They were the first to know that pleasure was always beneath the idea that one formed of it, and that the imagination went farther than nature. Once these basic truths were known, they learned first to veil their charms in order to awaken curiosity. They practiced the difficult art of refusing, even as they wished to consent. From that moment on, they knew how to set men's imagination afire. They knew how to arouse and direct desires as they pleased. Thus did beauty and love come into being. Now, the lot of women became less harsh. Not that they had managed to liberate themselves entirely from the state of oppression to which their weaknesses condemned them, but in the state of perpetual war that continues to exist between women and men, one has seen them, with the help of the caresses they have been able to invent, combat ceaselessly, sometimes vanquish, and often more skillfully take advantage of the forces directed against them. Sometimes, too, men have turned against women these weapons the women had forged to combat them, and their slavery has become all the harsher for it. Much more genius is needed to make love than to command armies. Ninon de L'Enclos. Hecuba, speaking about Helen of Troy, in Euripides' The Trojan Women, translated by Neil Curry. Menelaus, if you are really going to kill her, then my blessing go with you. But you must do it now, before her looks so twist to the strings of your heart that they turn your mind, for her eyes are like armies, and where her glances fall, their cities burn, until the dust of their ashes is blown by her sighs. I know her, Menelaus, and so do you, and all those who know her suffer. No man hath it in his power to overrule the deceitfulness of a woman. Marguerite of Navarre. A quotation by Alexander von Gleichen-Russwurm from The World's Lure, translated by Hannah Waller. This important sidetrack, by which women succeeded in evading man's strength and establishing herself in power, has not been given due consideration by historians. From the moment when the woman detached herself from the crowd, an individual finished product, offering delights which could not be obtained by force, but only by flattery, the reign of love's priestesses was inaugurated. It was a development of far-reaching importance in the history of civilization. Only by the circuitous route of the art of love could woman again assert authority, and this she did by asserting herself at the very point at which she would normally be a slave at the man's mercy. She had discovered the might of lust, the secret of the art of love, the demonic power of a passion artificially aroused and never satiated. The force thus unchained was thenceforth to count among the most tremendous of the world's forces, and at moments to have power even over life and death. The deliberate spellbinding of man's senses was to have a magical effect upon him, opening up an infinitely wider range of sensation and spurring him on as if impelled by an inspired dream. From The Art of Love by Ovid, translated by Peter Green. The first thing to get in your head is that every single girl can be caught, and that you'll catch her if you set your toils right. Birds will sooner fall dumb in springtime, cicadas in summer, or a hunting dog turn his back on a hare, than a lover's bland inducements can fail with a woman. Even one you suppose reluctant will want it. From On Love by José Ortega y Gasset, translated by Toby Talbot. The combination of these two elements, enchantment and surrender, is, then, essential to the love which we are discussing. What exists in love is surrender due to enchantment. From The Antichrist by Friedrich Nietzsche, translated by R.J. Hollingdale. What is good? All that heightens the feeling of power, the will to power, power itself in man. What is bad? All that proceeds from weakness. What is happiness? The feeling that power increases, that a resistance is overcome. From Seduction by Jean Baudrillard. The disaffection, neurosis, anguish and frustration encountered by psychoanalysis comes no doubt from being unable to love or to be loved, from being unable to give or take pleasure. But the radical disenchantment comes from seduction and its failure. Only those who lie completely outside seduction are ill, even if they remain fully capable of loving and making love. Psychoanalysis believes it treats the disorder of sex and desire, but in reality, it is dealing with the disorders of seduction. The most serious deficiencies always concern charm and not pleasure, enchantment and not some vital or sexual satisfaction. From Beyond Good and Evil, Friedrich Nietzsche, translated by Walter Kaufmann. Whatever is done from love always occurs beyond good and evil. From The Art of Love by Ovid, translated by Peter Green. Should anyone here in Rome lack finesse at lovemaking, let him try me. Read my book, and results are guaranteed. Technique is the secret. Charioteer, sailor, oarsman, all need it. Technique can control love himself. Most virtue is a demand for greater seduction. Natalie Barney.